Hello, and welcome to the reading of The Courier, the e-edition, for Tuesday, October 17th. And I am your narrator, Peter Welch, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network, for the blind and the disabled. All right, let's take a look here at the news for this beautiful Tuesday. It's going to be a high of about 68 degrees today. We got ourselves some really nice fall weather. Honorees named for 20 under 40 awards. Those doing good works, serving community, selected in Cedar Falls. Recipients have been named for the Courier's 20 under 40 awards class of 2023. 20 individuals who are doing good works and serving their communities in the Cedar Valley area were selected by a committee whose members sorted through nominations for the 21st Annual Award. A special event recognizing the 20 under 40 honorees will take place from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. November 14th at the Diamond Event Center at 5307 Caraway Lane. Tickets are $15 per person. Children 10 and under are free. Light appetizers and beverages will be served. One free drink ticket will be included with the ticket purchase. Tickets must be purchased in advance by the 6th of November. Available now at go.wcfcourier.com/20 and then under uppercase U and then lowercase NDER 40. Each honoree will receive two complimentary tickets, which will be available at check-in during the event. Sponsors the Community Foundation of the Northeast in the Northeast area. In July, the Courier began seeking nominations for the awards, which recognizes outstanding young leaders in the Cedar Valley area who are making the area a better place through what they do in their work and also their personal lives. Let's take a look at at some of the honorees here. We've got Brent Bovey, age 39, Rhinebeck and Parkersburg pharmacies. He's a pharmacy owner. Natalie Dolhe, age 37, Lincoln Savings Bank, commercial leadership manager. Janae Gui, age 32, CPM, acquisitions assistant corporate controller. Alex Hatch, age 37, Iowa Department of Health and Human Services contractor, public health professionals. Zach Hansen, age 27, Envision Architecture architect, and there's quite a long list here, but that is certainly some of the honorees that will be there. All right, what else is going on here in the paper here today? On the front page, we've got Iowa Mission of Mercy. Clinic repairs broken smiles. Women able to unapologetically to smile again for three free dental clinics in Waterloo. Catherine Quitivas struggled to quickly find a selfie in her phone's camera roll, but now, with new teeth, she expects her phone to be filled with them. Quitivas, age 26, received new front teeth from a free dental clinic in Waterloo provided by Iowa Mission of Mercy. The organization provided free dental services such as x-rays, cleanings, extractions, and fillings to anyone who showed up. When she arrived at the clinic after traveling from Des Moines, she described her front teeth as black slivers that practically chipped off at the touch. After pitching a tent outside 12 hours before the event started to ensure her place in line, Quitivas received a new removable partial denture called a flipper. The first thing she said she would do once receiving the flipper is to take a selfie. I'm going to smile for the first time in a very long time and actually mean it, she said, toothless, while waiting for the flipper. Even without having teeth, it's easier for me to smile because at least this way people aren't looking at my teeth. Over 1,000 people like Quitivas waited at the Waterloo Convention Center Friday and Saturday to receive crucial dental care. Iowa Mission of Mercy started the program in 2008 in Waterloo, and for the past 15 years has held an annual free dental clinic in different cities across the state. The number of patients and how much work the work would have cost was not immediately available. Historically, $1 million worth of work is performed. Well, that's certainly nice. Good for them. All right, let's turn to page two here. This is the Cedar Valley area section of the paper. Iowa GOP touts wins at governor's fundraiser. Guest speaker Riley Gaines argued against transgender women in women's sports. In Des Moines, Iowa Republicans celebrated the party's dominance in the state and recent legislative victories and heard from activist Riley Gaines during Governor Kim Reynolds' annual Harvest Festival fundraiser on Saturday. Speaking to a few hundred people at the Elwell Family Food Center at the Iowa State Fairgrounds, Reynolds lauded the red wave Iowa saw in 2022 when Republicans swept the congregational districts, won all but one statewide office, and expanded their majorities in the State House and Senate. The result, Reynolds said, is that Iowa remains a place of freedom, prosperity, and what I am most proud of, common sense. She touted recent conservative policy victories passed by Iowa's Republicans, like a massive school choice program, lowering taxes, passing a strict abortion ban. That abortion law is currently blocked while a lawsuit is argued. We ran on empowering parents, economic freedom, protecting life, a limited but responsive government, keeping our community safe, and most importantly, respecting those we serve, Reynolds went on to say. And I am so proud to say that we delivered on those promises. Reynolds also pointed to recent rankings that have placed Iowa among the top of lists for economic indicators like the cost of living, best places to raise a family, and best place to retire. Des Moines was recently ranked sixth, but best place to raise a family by U.S. News and World Report. And a recent Bankrate study placed Iowa as the top place to live for retirees. How about that? Reynolds and Republicans last year eliminated taxes on retirement income. Boy, that's fantastic. Okay, what else do we have here? Riley Gaines recount tie with transgender swimmer Leah Thomas. Riley Gaines, a former University of Kentucky NCAA swimmer who has launched a career as a media figure and activist after campaigning against the participation of transgender women in women's sports, the story of tying for fifth place with transgender swimmer Leah Thomas. Thomas, who first competed on the men's team at the University of Pennsylvania, sparked controversy in 2021 by competing in the women's division under the NCAA rules after undergoing a gender transition. Gaines frequently called Thomas a man and used Thomas' pre-transition name. Gaines and Thomas tied for fifth place in the 200-meter freestyle during the 2022 NCAA championship. Gaines said when the event ended, event officials gave the fifth place trophy to Thomas without providing a solid reasoning. They looked at me and said, "Riley, I'm sorry, but we've been advised that when photos are being taken, it's crucial that Leah is holding the trophy," she said. "That's when I was no longer waiting for someone else." Going beyond the participation of transgender women in sports, Gaines denied that transgender women are women and said cisgender women should stop referring to themselves as biological women. When you say biological woman, you're subconsciously admitting that there's an unbiological alternative, and there is not, she said. There's just man and woman. Gender dysphoria is recognized diagnosis by the American Psychiatric Association, and according to the association, the treatment for gender by dysphoria may include affirming the patient's gender through social transitioning and sometimes cross-sex hormones and surgeries. Attempts to force a transgender person to align with their gender assigned at birth, sometimes referred to as conversion therapy, is not advisable, according to the association. Reynolds signed a bill into law in 2022 that bans transgender women and girls from competing on sports teams in high school or college in Iowa. This year, Reynolds and Republicans passed a law that prohibits gender-affirming puberty blockers, hormones, and surgeries for minors. On National Coming Out Day earlier this week, the liberal advocacy organization Progress Iowa criticized Reynolds for passing legislation they say is harmful to the LGBTQ Iowans. Governor Reynolds and other elected officials across the state need to protect the most vulnerable, but instead choose to take away basic rights like gender-affirming health care, which saves lives, the group's executive director, Matt Sinovic, said. All right, let's see what else we have going on here. Again, this is the Waterloo section of the paper. Sunday fire destroys garage in Waterloo. An early morning fire destroyed a garage behind a Waterloo home on Sunday. Residents noticed the fire in the detached garage at 818 Newton Street around 5:10 a.m. The garage was filling with flames that damaged a motorcycle inside, and no injuries were reported. Truck fire damages home in Waterloo. A morning fire destroyed a pickup truck parked behind a Waterloo home on Saturday. Residents discovered the fire next to 921 West 2nd Street shortly after 7 a.m., and the blaze melted vinyl siding on the home and burned a wooden fence in the alley. Crews with Waterloo Fire Rescue extinguished the flames before they could cause further damage, and no injuries were reported there. And in also Waterloo, police investigate a Waterloo robbery. Police are investigating an attempted home robbery in Waterloo. Residents at 1820 East Mitchell Avenue told officers that a man armed with a gun entered their home around 7:10 p.m. Friday. The intruder demanded money but left empty-handed, according to police. No injuries were reported and no arrests have been made at this time. All right, let's see what else is going on here. Okay, now we're getting into the Cedar Valley section of the paper. And this is the Cedar Valley Breakdown. That's the title of our next article. And international bluegrass star Chris Jones and the Night Drivers will headline the first Cedargrass Music Festival Friday and Saturday at the Oster Regent Theater. The two-day festival will celebrate America's classic bluegrass genre with live performances and music workshops. Other headliners include Oklahoma-based Spring Street, Lori King, and Junction 64, the Bluegrass Blondies, Dry Run Creek, and the William Lawson Band. Hours are 5:15 to 10 p.m. Friday and 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Saturday. We're going out on a limb with the festival, and it's very ambitious for us to bring in all these bluegrass bands, said Greg Holt, the Oster Region's executive director. The theater is home to the Cedar Falls Community Theater, which presents an entire season of productions each year. However, it's also a great music venue on a historic stage in downtown Cedar Falls, he notes. When people come downtown and there's no theater production on stage, we need to be open and offering fun and exciting events. Music begins at 5:15 p.m. on Friday, runs until 10 p.m. On Saturday, music workshops are from 10 a.m. to noon, followed by an open stage showcasing local bands at 1 p.m. Headliners begin taking the stage at 1:30 p.m. And then jam sessions are planned late Saturday afternoon, and more local bands will hit the stage at 6:30 p.m. All of the headlining bands will perform throughout the day on Saturday, with Chris Jones and the Night Drivers closing out the festival at 9:15 p.m. Friday's tickets are $25 for adults, $10 for youths, $35 for VIP tickets. On Saturday, tickets are $30 for adults, $15 for youths, and $50 for VIP tickets. Two-day tickets are $50 for adults, $22 for youths, and $76 for VIP workshops are free with your ticket. And also, tickets are available online, and here's that web address, www.mycfct.org. Or you can go to the box office and you can call them also if you want, 319-277-5283. That's 319-277-5283. Iowa-based bluegrass performing Laurie King is thrilled to partner with the theater to organize the festival, and her production company has spearheaded outreach to performers like Chris Jones. Considered one of the great masters of bluegrass, Jones and his band have won numerous International Bluegrass Music Association awards and racked up more than 20 number one songs. The band made its Grand Ole Opry debut in July of 2022, signed to the Mountain Home Music Company. Jones and other night drivers have recorded 4 critically acclaimed albums. Either as a solo artist or band, Jones has recorded 14 albums and toured the world. He's a star to the bluegrass scene, and he does a show on Sirix XM Radio. Truegrass and getting him is a huge asset. It's exciting that he's coming here. That was one of the key factors we thought could bring audiences to Cedar Falls, King goes on to explain. King herself has been performing and recording bluegrass music since the 1990s as a vocalist and upright bass player, as well as presenting bluegrass events for 21 years. She was executive director of the Bluegrass Association from 2009 until 2020. The organization dissolved during the COVID-19 pandemic. King and her husband Joe were members of Bluegrass Addiction before forming their own award-winning band. They've released 3 albums, and King has released numerous singles. She has won awards as a bass fiddler player and traditional female vocalist, among other honors, as well as recognition from the Iowa Arts Council. BNKD will take Autumn Ridge changes to Cedar Falls Council. Request to increase number of dwellings was rejected by P&Z. In Cedar Falls, BNKD Development plans to take its amended Autumn Ridge plan directly to the City Council after it was unanimously rejected by the city's zoning board. The company wants to build 86 dwellings on 22.5 acres southwest of First Street and Union Road, a significant increase from the 58 residences originally envisioned in the master plan in 2013. The Planning and Zoning Commission on September 16th rejected the amendment in a 6-0 vote. Two members recused, and one was absent. Planning and Community Services Manager Karen Howard expects BNKND's petition to go before the council next month. That proposed change in quantity, along with stormwater management and flooding concerns involving previous development, drove the opposition from neighbors this summer. It would be the second time in recent meetings that the council would be asked to overrule the Planning Commission. Last month, the council voted 6-1 in favor of a code change requested by St. Patrick Catholic Church that will benefit all civic and institutional organizations downtown. The measure required a council supermajority and allowed for a parking lot to be constructed across the street from the church's main facilities off 7th Street. BNKD Development currently plans to construct 86 residences, 42 single-family bi-attached dwellings, and 44 single-family detached dwellings in Autumn Ridge. That's a reduction from the 90 previously proposed this summer, but still a far cry from the 58 single-family units proposed in 2013. Owner Dennis Happel previously told the Courier that the driving reason behind the change was it's what people are asking for and the price point people want to get to. All right, let's take a look very quickly here at some Metro briefs. LSI receives a $15,000 grant in Waterloo. Lutheran Services in Iowa received $15,000 from the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa to support its Blackhawk County HOPES program. HOPES, an evidence-based early childhood program, serves parents from pregnancy until their child is 5 years old. Families work with LSI family support specialists through regular home visits to strengthen and empower children and parents. Through home visits, support specialists help families set, work towards, and reach goals. Additionally, LSI Home Visitors connect parents and parents-to-be with community resources and groups. All right, let's see what else do we have here. So we turn the page. All right, now we've got from the front page in Cedar Valley. Let's take a look here and see what else we've got. Defense begins in officer's sexual exploitation trial. Allison, attorneys for a former Clarksville police officer accused of exchanging nude pictures with teens and showing girls material from a child porn investigation, began presenting their case in court. Michael William Tobin Jr., age 35, who had been a lieutenant with the department, is charged with sexual exploitation of a minor. Defense attorney Nellie O'Mara delivered a brief opening statement after the state rested on Friday. Did Mr. Tobin request or send naked pictures? Did Mr. Tobin show the Cody Blue file of minors? I ask you to listen to all of the evidence, and you will hear three answers. No, no, and no, O'Mara said. Prosecutors allege that Tobin traded pictures with a 16-year-old girl with whom he was having an affair while he was a police officer, used the teen to ask her friend to pass along more nude photos, and showed photos and videos of nude teens from an investigation into local sex offender Cody Blue. Earlier testimony included the town mayor describing February 14, 2021 incident where he arrived at the police station and found the teen in the office with Tobin and the teen's car parked in the police garage. Tobin told the mayor he was fixing the girl's car. On Friday, the defense buttressed that assertion by putting the teen's mother on the stand. The mother showed text conversations she, the mother, had with Tobin. The text described how Tobin was working to fix a heater core on the girl's car around that time. But under cross-examination by the state, the mother broke down in tears as she testified about how she had put her trust in Tobin. I trusted police officers until this happened, said the mother, who had family in law enforcement. I trusted him. He told me he was a man of God. She said Tobin held himself out as a youth mentor. The mother continued to sob in front of the jury as the judge held a brief sidebar discussion with the prosecutor and the defense attorney. Also on Friday, a private investigator for the defense said he attempted to discern when the Cody Blue files had been accessed on Tobin's computer at the police station. Kip Ireland testified that when a computer file is opened, it will show up as modified in the system's file browser. As soon as you double-click any of that, it modifies, Ireland said. He said that last time that the blue file was modified was February 21st of 2022. He also testified he was unable to tell other times when the file was accessed. Grow Cedar Valley, CEO retiring in 2024. Dara plans to leave in the spring, group seeking a new leader. In Waterloo, Grow Cedar Valley has begun the search for a new CEO. Carrie Dara, the organization's current president and CEO, will retire in the spring of 2024. The decision was very strategic in timing, said Dara, whose tenure at the Regional Economic Development Organization began in 2018. I knew when I was hired last 5 to 7 years is a healthy length of time to be in this position. I knew there would come a time when a different leadership style would be important to the organization, and I believe that time is now, Dara goes on to say. I feel good about my decision professionally and personally. I'm handing off the organization in a healthy state. It's an incredible moment for Grow Cedar Valley, said Mike Malero, chief of the Grow Cedar Valley Board of Directors and CEO of VGM Group Incorporated. We're celebrating all the significant contributions Carrie has made, and we're also looking ahead towards a truly bright future for Grow Cedar Valley as we search for the leader who will champion that growth. The job opening was listed Monday online at growcedarvalley.com. That's GROWCEDAR valley.com. Dara predicts that the leader will be a creative visionary who will lead this team toward the future and toward accomplishing things we've been dreaming about and make Grow Cedar Valley even more effective. Formerly VP of Community Development for Grow Cedar Valley and president of the Cedar Valley Tech Works Campus, Dara oversaw redevelopment of the 33-acre industrial brownfield and former manufacturing site. The land and buildings on the west side of downtown Waterloo along Westfield Avenue and Commercial Street were donated by John Deere. Under Grow Cedar Valley auspices, TechWorks has become a hub of advanced manufacturing and technology and home to Hawkeye Community College's new 5.1 million Automation and Robotics Center. Other businesses include Lincoln Savings Bank and the Marriott Courtyard Hotel. Grow Cedar Valley's offices are located on the TechWorks campus as well. All right, let's continue also now with more Cedar Valley news. GOP's Scott meets Waterloo voters. Presidential hopeful stopped by Starbucks. Waterloo, James Atten never heard words uttered by Senator Tim Scott that he didn't agree with. And that's why he and wife Patty and son Matthew of Waterloo make sure to attend the Presidential Hopefuls campaign event on Friday at Starbucks Smokehouse in hopes that he will tell him now how he feels about his stances. The Attens were among a couple dozen to hear from the last of this big-name candidates to pass through the Cedar Valley and advancing of caucusing, in January. He's on board with those common-sense American values that the Midwest is known for, Atten said before the man from South Carolina. But deep down, I don't know if he has a chance to win the primary. Scott's appearance was a bit different than that of a former VP, Mike Pence, another Republican presidential candidate who a few weeks ago stopped also at Starbucks. During Pence's event, the dining area was cleared of tables and rows of seating were added in anticipation of him addressing everyone together at the front of the room. Originally, staffers said that Scott didn't anticipate giving a stump speech offering thoughts publicly and answering questions altogether from the crowd. Instead, he was planning a more intimate event and going table to table, talking privately with attendees. And that's how it started. But a brief celebration of his communication director's birthday focused everyone's attention on Scott. The room was relatively quiet, and he took advantage of the moment. Scott gave a brief speech, took a slew of questions, including from Atten, who seized the moment to tell the candidate how he feels. He inquired further about Scott's plans to close the southern border shared with Mexico and take security to another level. I think we need to go a little further, said Atten. I think we need to close the doors to the enemies of the U.S. who keep coming in every day and are causing these big problems. Scott leaned on criticism of the weak sitting President Joe Biden by responding that the current administration has left the inviting border insecure, unsafe, and wide open. The two-term senator noted how he'd finished the wall expansion of the Mexico-United States barrier begun under former President Donald Trump. He also used military technology to better surveil the areas in question and change policies, such as those addressing asylum, to limit people who enter in hopes of limiting the spread of fentanyl in the country, among other things. I would do that immediately from day one, said Scott. We are reaching the half-hour time of our broadcast here today, and I would like to remind you that we are reading the e-edition of the Courier. And I am Peter Welch, and I'm your narrator. And this is Tuesday, October 17th, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. Okay, we have reached the half-hour point, and what I'm going to do next is I'm going to read some obituaries here, and then we'll continue on with our reading here in the editorial section of the paper today. James Geiger has passed. In lieu of flowers, if you feel moved, you can give in Jim's honor to his daughter's nonprofits. And I'm going to spell this out. GODSPEEDEQUINE.org. Arlen Schmidt has passed at the age of 93 of Waterloo. He was housed in the North Crest Specialty Care home. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, October 17th at Grace Lutheran Church with burial at Garden of Memories Cemetery, and both in Waterloo. Military honors by Denver American Legion Post 653 and the Iowa Army National Guard Funeral Honor Guards. Visitation for 1 hour prior to services at the church. Memorials may be directed to the church or Habitat for Humanity. Condolences may be left at the following phone number, 319-233-3146, and that would be at the Locke Funeral Services organization, who is taking care of everything there. Ronald Hens has passed, and let me take a quick look here. I'm looking down here. Celebration of Life will be held on Saturday, the 21st of October, from 12 to 5 p.m. at the New Hartford Community Center in New Hartford, Iowa. And then we've got Rita Welter, who's passed at the age of 97, who passed at the hospice in Cedar Valley on Friday, the 13th of October. And memorials in lieu of flowers, Rita and her family would welcome memorial donations to St. Patrick's Catholic Church to be used to support Catholic education in the parish. Memorials may be directed in Rita's name and this address. And here it is. It's St. Patrick's Catholic Church, 705 Main Street, Cedar Falls, Iowa, 50613. And the family would also like to express our heartfelt thanks to Western Home Communities and Care Initiatives Hospice for the gentle, loving care they provided for their mother. Right. Let's now go back here to the other page here, to the opinion section of the paper. Okay, we've got a guest columnist here today. Let's take a look and see what we have here. This is the import of lost caucuses. And this is written by Dave Nagel. Iowa Democratic Party leaders returned last week from St. Louis, where the fate of Iowa's first in the nation caucus status was determined. Rita Hart and others proclaimed a great victory. Iowa no longer will host a competitive presidential contest to lead off the nominating season. Instead, Democrats traded this honored spot for permission to hold a meeting. Having lost their pants, Democrats should be grateful that they were allowed to come home in their underwear. But we are reassured that having the caucus reduced to a simple party organizing function, which we do every year anyway, which will enable us to focus on a new objective. We're going to devote our efforts to electing Democrats. We need to be honest. The party lost, rural America's lost, and the nation lost to a new nominating process that will place more and more emphasis on money and less on presidential candidates being measured by personal one-on-one interaction with voters. Saying that we are going to start anew and focus on the electing Democrats implies that the party hasn't been doing this for the last 40 years when we had the caucuses and won our fair share. I guess we best call up former Senator Tom Harkin, author of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and tell him he never was elected. Alert Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, he was not governor for two terms, and Leonard Boswell's heirs will be surprised that he never served multiple terms in Congress. Mike Gronstall was never Iowa's Senate Majority Leader. Don Avinson never ruled the Iowa House for 6 years as Speaker and changed the name of all the federally funded projects Neil Smith brought home to Iowa, including the money that helped rebuild the state after the flood of 1994. So here's the first thing the party lost. The strengthening of the Iowa Democratic Party by the presence of presidential candidates and their money and staff brought to Iowa over the years. For example, I can remember watching how State Senator Eric Giddens benefited by having every presidential candidate contribute resources and staff presence to enable him to win a special election in March of 2019. Instead of working to be more competitive, we're going to be left with a party and candidates to compete against a well-funded GOP with a massive financial advantage that will be extremely difficult to overcome. But there may be an even greater diminishment when one considers the fact that Iowa was the only rural state in the early nominating process to select the party nominee to be the president of the U.S. We sit in a state like the others that border us and watch our rural hospitals close or see a new lower standard of medical care for citizens of small towns. We regret but are now powerless to stop our small town schools' struggles to find adequate funding to fulfill their mission because the money is diverted to private educational institutions. We're told we should worry more about which bathroom a person chooses to use and what sports they should be allowed to participate in based on their perceived gender. We pride ourselves on banning books. We will have to instruct the female voter to call her state senator or representative doctor since the legislature will make her most intimate health care decisions for her. By reforming child labor laws, our children will skip school to work in our hog slaughtering and chicken plucking factories. Now, would-be presidential contenders will not grace our land to argue against these conditions. This is the existing order of life in farm country. Of course, there are reasons the governor of New Hampshire held a celebratory press conference when he learned that his state would hold the first contest in the Democratic Party. Iowa has been eliminated, but there is also reason to hope, because at least the last with the early date was saved for party organization. While a mistake of major proportions has been made, nothing except our will precludes us from returning to the top of the heap in 2028. The party has good leadership and is for the most part working to restore Iowa to a two-party state. It is on this issue, however, calling St. Louis a victory is simply an attempt to hide what we lost. But we can get it back with some backbone. And that, again, was written by Dave Nagel, who's a Waterloo attorney and former U.S. congressman. All right. All right, let's see what else we've got here today. Food and farm file. Beef's new range war won't be over grass. The cattle's market future, like the West Wild and Rowdy Pass, will feature sweat, brawls, and blood. And that's just the meatpacking side, because today's fast-thinning cattle numbers, plus the rise of at least 8 new smaller beef packers, promise a bruising fight among the upstarts. And big meat for enough cattle to keep kill lines at capacity and any packer within a mile of being profitable. Current beef cattle numbers show just how cutthroat the coming fight will be. Last year's widespread drought forced cattlemen to cull herds, and the first fire sale pushed U.S. cattle slaughter up a whopping 13% over 2021 and dropped this year's cattle inventory to 89 million head, or nearly 3 million less than 2022. Heavier slaughter weights can make up for lower slaughter numbers. For example, you can, according to a September posting on Farm Journal's Ag Web, this year's cattle slaughter will yield 27 billion pounds of beef, or 3 billion more pounds than 1975's herd of 132 million head. But the extra weight doesn't solve today's packer problems, said John Nelvica, a market expert. There's just not enough cattle for today's packers to kill, he told FJ, let alone for 8 newcomers, too. Beef packer capacity utilization, Navica explained, will be around 87% this year. And I project it will be about 80% next year without any additional capacity added. The drop at cow plants, slaughterhouses that handle lower quality old mama cows, will even greater. Packers need capacity utilization to run from 90% to 94% to capture efficiencies of size and maintaining profitability, Nelvica adds. Next year's steep drop in steer and heifer slaughter will make 2024 an even messier challenge for Packers than 2023. Few in cattle country will lose sleep over Tyson Foods, JBS Cargill, Nationals' money-losing woes. The Packers, after all, made obscenely fat profits off cowboys and feedlots for nearly a decade, so watching them whine and wiggle and wraggle for slaughter cattle might be more entertaining than attending the local rodeo. In fact, those obscenely huge profits, especially during the pandemic, helped fuel rancher and feedlot interests to invest in most of today's new smaller regional slaughterhouse plants, some like True West Beef and Jerome promise 500 head daily capacity. Others like producer-owned beef in Amarillo, Texas, are aiming for 3,000 head daily kill. All total, at least 8 Packer projects that have the potential to add 11,700 head to daily slaughter capacity are in various stages of completion, FJ related. Given those facts, have these meatpacking newcomers, mostly cow-punching ranchers and boots-on-the-ground feedlot owners, climbed out of their saddles only to walk straight into a deadliest, bloodiest meatpacker shakeout in recent memory? Maybe, but most hope there that their smaller size will make them more able to find profitable niches in local and regional markets and underserved by the Packer elephants. One website, Sustainable Beef of North Platte, Nebraska, is doing just that by hooking up with the elephant of U.S. groceries, giant Walmart. According to Successful Farming SF magazine, last year, Walmart acquired a minority stake in Sustainable Beef, promised to buy most of the beef it produces. Large cuts of Sustainable Beef's carcasses will be trucked to Walmart's new $257 million plant in Olathe, Kansas, to become a meat case-ready steaks, fillets, and more for Walmart Midwestern stores. The Sustainable Walmart pairing is just the most recent example of big food finding another way to capitalize on rural America's increasing need for alternative and often less than ideal routes around heavily concentrated, deeply uncompetitive markets like today's big ag biz dominated by dairy, beef, pork, and poultry markets. Will these smaller packer giant retailer participants work? For the chosen few, Kansas rancher and private meat packer Mike Calicrete told SF, they might be rewarded, but since no one has tackled the underlying issues of concentration, consolidation, and captive supply, he adds it won't be long before the market will become even less competitive. History confirms Calicrete's clear-eyed forecast. Big meat, after all, has the bankroll to ride out market storms, and the startups, on the other hand, mostly just have hope. And again, that was written by Alan Gubert, and this is the Farm and Food File, is published weekly throughout the U.S. and Canada. All right, let's press on here and see what else we've got going on here in the paper today. Here's an article here, Public Lands Critical for Iowa Residents, stakeholders say. Ensuring that there is sufficient public land in the state for Iowans to hunt, fish, and enjoy recreational activities is critical to maintaining and growing the state's population, stakeholders say. Recreation and conservation stakeholders discussed the availability and maintenance of public lands during a session at the Gazette's Iowa Ideas Conference on Friday. The topic of public land use and availability gained attention early this year when state lawmakers considered a proposal that would have required the state to focus on the maintenance of current public land over the acquisition of any new public land. The proposal sparked a debate over how much public land is available to Iowans and whether the acquisition of new public lands has made it difficult for farmers to acquire land. That initial legislative proposal did not pass into law. However, lawmakers in the Republican-majority Iowa legislature did approve legislation that eliminated a goal for the state to reach the point where 10% of Iowa's land is publicly owned. The state was falling far short of the goal anyway. Just 3% of Iowa's land is publicly owned, according to studies by Texas A&M University Natural Resources Institute and the hiking and climbing website, the Summit Post. That puts Iowa near the bottom of state shares of publicly owned land. Only Kansas, Nebraska, Rhode Island had lower shares of publicly owned land than Iowa in the two reports. Iowa acquired 2,462 acres of land in 2022, a state official said during a legislative hearing in March. I'm not concerned about our ranking. That number really doesn't mean anything to us, Joe McGovern, president of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, said during the Iowa Idea discussion. What we've really been talking about is, do we have enough parks, trails, wildlife areas in this state to meet the outdoor recreation needs of Iowans? And then in addition to that, do we have enough land to attract workforce? Do people want to come when they find a job? Or are they looking for jobs? Is this a place they want to come to work? So we've really looked at it as, well, not that it's too much land or too little land. It's more, well, we're meeting the needs of Iowans. Are we doing that? And I don't think we are there yet. Mark Beltram, who lobbies at the Iowa Capitol on behalf of Ducks Unlimited, acknowledged a shortage of grazing areas for Iowa cattle farmers. Members of the Iowa Cattlemen's Association were among the most vocal to speak in support of the initially proposed legislation earlier this year. Beltram said that his family has cattle on their 850 acres in Marion and Lucas counties. I know from personal experience that there's a shortage of grazing, Beltram said. Let's make sure that we are maximizing the grazing opportunities on public lands. McGovern agreed and said conservation groups and agricultural interests can work together. For example, he said that grazing can be a part of managing a grassland or a prairie. If we can find a way to work together, I guarantee any conservation group would welcome that. Having the dialogue around how do we integrate in good grazing practices on our grasses, things like that, McGovern also went on to say. All right, we have turned the page here, and now we are looking at the weather forecast. Today is going to be a high of 65 degrees, and it's going to be sunny. Tonight it will be pleasant, a cool 47 degrees. Tomorrow on Wednesday, breezy, a brief PM shower possibly, a high of 69, a low of 48. Thursday, cooler, breezy in the AM, 60 degree for a high and 43 for a low. Friday, it'll be partly sunny and pleasant, a high of 67 and a low of 43 degrees. And the outlook for Saturday, partly sunny and windy, a high of 65 and a low of 41. The national forecast outlook is today will remain cool across much of the east, with a shower or two in portions of the northeast. Warmer weather will enter the plain states, and that air will remain warm across the southwest. A storm moving through southern Canada will produce showers from Washington into Idaho, Montana, and eventually northwestern North Dakota. All right, so much for our weather forecast. I think we could say that we are entering now into the beginning of Indian summer as it warms up here for a little bit. Certainly my favorite time of the year. Let's take a look at 360 degrees column next. Okay, and in bold headlines, it says, Echoes of Holocaust. And this is about the Mideast with the ongoing war with the Israelis and the Palestinians. Let's take a look at this. This is was written out of Tel Aviv. Israel, women, children, older adults hiding in safe rooms, gunned down mercilessly. Homes set ablaze with terrified residents still inside them. Children, some bound, forced into a room and slaughtered. Jews, helpless. For many Israelis and Jews around the world, the horrors committed by Hamas militants during their stunning onslaught on southern Israeli communities is triggering painful memories of a calamity of a far greater scale, the Holocaust. Long seen as a catastrophe so horrific nothing else should be compared to it, Israelis are now drawing direct parallels between the murder of 6 million Jews in Europe eight decades ago, and their most recent tragedy, underscoring how traumatic the attack has been for a country that rose from the ashes of World War II and was created as a safe haven for Jews. I've been strict about not using the word Shoah in any context other than the Holocaust, political commentator Ben Caspit wrote in the Daily Mariv, referring to the Holocaust by its Hebrew name. When Jewish children hide in a protected room and their anguished parents pray that they won't cry so that the marauders won't come in and set the house on fire, it's a Shoah. Israeli retaliation against Hamas in Gaza has also drawn comparisons to the Palestinians' greatest national tragedy, the Nakba, when hundreds of thousands fled or were forced to flee following the 1948 war that led to Israel's creation. Many Palestinians fear a repeat of that mass exodus after Israel ordered the evacuation of northern Gaza. Just a few years ago, comparisons to the Holocaust would have been promptly denounced as cheapening its memory and diminishing the horror of the Nazi crimes. That has begun to erode in recent years, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu alluding to the Nazis when talking about Iran and its nuclear program, and protesters on rival sides of the political aisle calling each other Nazis. Still, such incidents remain rare and often do draw criticism. But the horrors of the October 7th Hamas assault, which killed at least 1,300 Israelis, have tapped into Israel's deepest fears and revived memories of the Jews' greatest trauma. Hundreds of militants stormed across the border, catching the country and its vaunted military off guard on a major Jewish holiday. They attacked sleepy farming villages, slaughtering terrified residents. The militants killed at least 260 revelers at a music festival, with survivors telling harrowing stories of methodical massacres. Dozens were dragged away as hostages on motorcycles and golf carts. Some of the dead captured were Holocaust survivors. "This is a massacre. This is a pogrom," said Major General Itilia Ventru, leader of forces that cleared one of the besieged villages, referring to historic massacres of European Jews. In the Holocaust, the Nazis led a campaign of genocide, rounding up and murdering many of Europe's Jews while sending others on trains to death or labor camps. Israel made protecting Jews from similar atrocities part of its raison d'etre, or reason to be. Many Israelis see their country as a refuge, a nation with a strong army that could protect Jews despite regional threats. Many Jews in the diaspora share that feeling, seeing Israel as a safe haven should Jews be persecuted again. While the Hamas attack did not nearly approach the Holocaust scale, it marked the deadliest day for Jews since then, and its well-planned slaughter reopened a wound that remains fresh for many in Israel. Netanyahu compared the festival killings to the Babi Yar massacre, one of the most infamous mass slaughters of World War II, in which more than 33,000 Jews were killed. He has declared that Israel will never forget, a clear reflection of Israel's vow to never let the Holocaust disappear from the world's collective memory. Danny Kushmararo, an Israeli newscaster, began referring to the Hamas militants as those Nazis. Israel's allies abroad also have made the connection. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken referred to his late father-in-law, a Holocaust survivor, during a visit to Israel, and said that the attacks had harrowing echoes of Nazi massacres. Well, that just about does it here for the reading of the e-edition of the Courier here for Tuesday, and that of October 17th. And you have been listening to Peter Welch. I am your narrator. And you've been also listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. Get out there if you can and enjoy this beautiful weather. It's sunny and dry, and it's not going to last, folks. We are rapidly getting into mid-fall, and you know what comes after that. Take care, everybody, and we'll talk again very soon. Bye-bye now.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.